So actual property offenses
per
1,000 residents. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the Police Bureau's key performance measure around that. And actually, I'm glad we touched on that because it's so one thing that may or may not be obvious from the visual is that property crimes comprise the vast majority of crimes. So that's meant to show the bar graph is meant to show that. So there are about 80% of crimes committed in the city. Any other questions on that?
Do we keep comparative data about how what are the equivalent numbers of peer cities?
You know, I don't have that right at my fingertips, but I'm sure that we could take a look at that. And
well, that would be one way of knowing whether we're even in the same ballpark,
mm-hmm.
right? So that would if the number was substantially off, because again, we can debate at great length the question of how are these numbers arrived at? Are people adequately reporting crimes? You know, what's our methodology, et cetera? But what it's useful for is trend line. It, mm-hmm. it shows trends. So it that was, even with the imperfect methodology of the auditor's survey, you got trends mm-hmm. over time, and that was helpful. But I think it'd be interesting, to the extent we consider, you know, peer cities like by population, like Atlanta, Seattle, and others, I think it would be interesting to know where they are in terms of property crimes per 1,000 residents, just to know how we measure up.
Thank you.
Some context.
We can definitely take a look at that and work with the Bureau on that.
Shannon, before you go on, Commissioner Fish, my team has reached out to a number of peer cities on some costs of police and fire, facilities, fleet, technology, overtime, and I'm happy to collaborate with the budget office on the peer city research.
Yeah, I would love to have those numbers at my fingertips for all the people from out of state that are railing at us for what they see on the Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
What a terrible place we are. I'm like, no, actually, your place is worse.
Right, that is the power of data. Yes.
Is there any further breakdown available within these categories of the types of crimes? For instance, crimes against property can include anything from trespassing and vandalism to arson, burglary, and more serious crimes. And I'm interested in seeing how much of this is being driven by poverty and homelessness, because if we have hundreds of people trespassing to try to find somewhere dry to sleep at night, that's not an indicator to me that we need more police on the streets.
So differentiating major property crimes from lower level.
Yeah.
Great.
Is that available or?
I don't know that.
It's not in, I mean, I'm sure that the Bureau has that.
Okay.
Yeah. We can. Sounds like there's a little bit of follow-up on this
Well,
section.
If anybody's listening, I would like that information.
AC Davis says it's available.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. So, and we'll talk a little bit about recommendations with regards to reported crime. But I, you know, and just noting that, you know, we have added resources to the Police Bureau. That will take time to see if those additional officers can make a dent in this sort of population level indicator. Yeah.
I think your statements about that got buried in our going back to the previous table. Just say
again
how many positions we added.
We added 55 positions in last year's budget, but 49 officer positions that would relate to this type of work. So I just wanted to note that because that's something that, you know, we could see impacts in the out years on that. Clearly, we wouldn't see them, you know, this year, but something to check in on as we move into future years. The other thing I'd like to note is we do have other programs outside of the Bureau that seek to address crime rates. So one in particular is Civic Life's property crime prevention program. And that's a pretty key strategy for addressing property crime. Wanted to note that Civic Life has made changes to their program structure to make it more aligned with precinct boundaries, more team-based approach. And the Bureau is really hoping that that makes the program more effective. So I know there's been a lot of movement on that, so I just wanted to mention that. And we can see if some of those changes might have an impact. Okay, so there's a lot to cover in this section. So the next we're going to look at the different bureaus and how we're doing around our call volume and how that translates into emergency response times. So we'll start with the Police Bureau. So whether we refer to it as call volume, calls for service, incidents, really the demand for our public safety agencies has increased pretty steadily over the last few years for Police Bureau, Fire Bureau, and for emergency communications. Generally, these two indicators have what I notice is an inverse relationship. As demand for those services increases, we would expect those response times to slow down, all else being equal. And here we're going to focus just on the actual volume. So with the Police Bureau, this graph is showing you dispatch calls by type. So high, medium, and low. As you can see, those have increased over the last 6 years. But really, that increase, if you look a little bit more closely, has been driven by low and medium priority calls, which we know from the Bureau tend to be disorder type calls.
Could you define a few things here? Could you define dispatched calls, please?
So dispatch calls, I might need my police analyst to have a more precise definition.
And I'd also like to know the difference between a low and a medium priority, if you could give us some examples.
Sure. Katie Schreif for the City Budget Office. We also have folks here from the Police Bureau that may be better suited to answer this question. The first question was, remind me.
What is a dispatched call?
So this is actually two different types of calls. You'll see dispatch calls, which is basically like, you know, calls coming into BOEC that an officer is dispatched to, and it's also calls that an officer self-dispatches to. So an officer sees something, you know, they'll call in reporting and say, I'm dispatching myself to this call. So it's both of those call types embedded in there.
And then as far as dispatched calls a subset of calls received by BOEC?
It would be dispatch calls specifically for the Police Bureau, yes, would be a subset of calls received by BOEC.
Would dispatched calls into BOEC to the Police Bureau be a subset of calls to the Police Bureau? So you have self-dispatched and you have BOEC dispatched. Is that all of the calls that come into BOEC for the police?
It's all the calls that come into BOEC for the police, I believe, but the Police Bureau is also going to be receiving, you know, sort of online reporting and telephone reporting. I'm looking over at AC Davis to confirm that.
That's a small percentage.
It's a small percentage,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, I think that's helpful. And then could I just get some idea of what the difference between a medium and a low priority call is?
Sure. I mean, all of it has to do with sort of the urgency of the call and whether or not there's sort of an active crime or issue in progress. So you can have very serious crimes that can sometimes be a low priority just because, you know, the incident, if you will, has already passed. So, you know, the urgency of arriving within 6 minutes isn't necessarily there.
Is that discretionary, or are there an actual list of calls, types of crimes that are considered by definition medium priority and others by definition low priority? How are you determining what goes into these categories?
So these are categories determined by, you know, sort of BOEC and dispatching. Right now there's actually a pilot program in place that there's a sergeant for, I believe, the first time at BOEC, sort of helping to prioritize those calls and saying, like, that's probably a medium priority, this is a high priority, because it is a little bit of a sort of you know, a discretionary activity, right, is sort of prioritizing those calls. So my understanding is that there are some types of calls that would always be a high priority, but there's a fair amount of sort of discretion based on whether or not there's urgency
this variety. Is helpful, and the reason I'm asking all these annoying questions is I'm trying to get at the growth rate of low priority calls. Is it a thing, or are we changing the definition of some calls that used to be medium priority based on the number of officers available to respond? How do we know that low priority in 2013 was the same as low priority in 2018?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And actually, we talked with the Police Bureau about that because it's a little bit of both, right? So there's only so many officers responding to calls, and so that there is some sort of changing over time in what is a high priority call, just because there's only so many high priority calls that you can physically respond to, right? So in that sense, things do get pushed down to medium or lower priority calls just based on the sheer volume and ability to respond. That said, in talking to, you know, the Strategic Services Division at Police, you know, they can kind of confirm for us that the driving factors in increased call volume, especially for those low priority calls, are really around the disorder type calls that are generally a lower priority.
Thank you.
Mayor, Katie is our CBO analyst at OMF. I've never heard her tell me I asked a fantastic question. So good work. But I'm going to try. So
they'll get there, Tom.
Katie, in the pop, I set myself up. Katie, in the high, medium, low priority aggregate, do we know with the growth, population growth in Portland that was referred to when Josh was up here?
No, I was.
I'm not. Thank you very much.
It was my question.
That's the best question I've ever heard.
That's it.
Is it a fantastic question,
trend of population growth? It's a very serious question.
Yeah.
Does it trend with population growth? Or are we out of whack in terms of the growth of all those call categories, irrespective to our population growth?
I just Googled it. Yeah.
Obviously, those trends go together. I can't recall off the top of my head how much of these sort of like nominal amounts are driven by demand. I'm looking around to see if anybody else around here knows that off their head. But we can get you that information.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom, for asking my question. And I just want to point out to everyone at the table, when I look at this chart, I only see a change in the gray. The blue and orange boxes look relatively the same. But I did the math. So in high priority calls, we've seen less than a 10% increase in 5 years. Medium priority calls, 25% increase. And low priority, 32% increase.
Yep.
These graphs can be a little challenging. And I do think that population growth, we have to look at population growth at the same time to really understand these numbers.
Right. And Josh just came up here and gave us that the population growth over that time has been 8% versus a 30% growth in call volume.
Yeah. 8% over 5 years.
You think like an economist.
I don't know what is happening.
Josh, you've had an influence, whether you know it or not.
I'll take it.
Okay, that's great.
Thanks, Katie.
We might need you again then. We'll see.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate
great
that.
Discussion. So sticking with this Police Bureau calls for service, so again with the high, medium, and low priority calls, so the other, the inverse of the call volume, as we spoke before, is that what is that response time? And here you see that across the board, response times have gone up over the last 5 years, but they've gone up most precipitously with medium and low priority calls. So similar to how you saw on the other graph. And specifically with the high priority call volume, things have remained pretty stable over the past to the prior year. So between 16-17 and 17-18, and that's worth noting as well. So for high priority, that's 6.6 minutes in average travel time and 2 minutes in average dispatch queue time. Any questions on that?
I do have a question. I have a comment to Willamette Week and others. I was only in charge of Burke for 5 months, so any of this is a result of some things that happened actually during the recession at BOAC, where we were not able to have as many people in the academy and getting trained. Also, the changeover to the new computer system there, mm-hmm. which then had an effect on call times in the 12 to 16 area where Commissioner Novick was in charge. And then I think we're also seeing the reflection of what's happening with the call volumes going up, the crime levels going up a little bit, mm-hmm. and then that has the effect here. So it's all tying it together.
Certainly, and we'll talk more specifically about BOAC as well. And because this is primarily the resources from the Police Bureau side of the call, and that because that entire response time is, you know, someone calls 911, they reach emergency communications, and then they're moved along, dispatched, and then an officer responds.
So, what's meant by queue time?
All these technical questions. So, do you want to come on up? Great, thank you.
So. Yeah, to your point, Commissioner Chris Davis from the Police Bureau. This graphic here actually only represents what happens to the call once BOAC is done with it.
Okay.
And it's in our hands. And so this is the time from when BOAC has set up the call. It's in the system. Queue time is the time that the call waits for an officer to become available to take it after it gets in the system.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was easy. Thank you.
Great. So, in keeping with looking again at this, continuing on call volume and emergency response, wanted to touch on some of the other bureaus as well, because the trends are actually a little bit different depending on our agency that we look at. So this graph is talking about fire high priority calls, so fire bureau incidents and response to those incidents. And here you see really my main takeaway is that response times from the fire bureau have actually held fairly steady. Now, I know that the graph doesn't communicate that immediately. See the big blip in 16-17. In looking at the data, it's understood that a lot of that additional travel time might have come from the January months when we had the snowstorm that year, and our fire, our public response was quite impacted for a period of time. And other than that, we see the response times holding pretty steady. So,
Shannon, before you go, what do you attribute that to? I neglected to ask this in the prep, so sorry.
The snow or the...
Just know the generally holding steady.
Yeah.
Have there been there operational changes or
exactly.
best practice improvements with...
Yeah, thank you. And holding steady in spite of increased workload, right? So that's the really interesting thing. So there's a couple of different things that we see the Bureau implementing that are notable. One is the implementation of automatic vehicle locator. So that's using GPS on apparatus so that the closest fire truck can be assigned to an incident and not just the fire truck that's housed within that fire management area. So that's a big change that the Bureau's put into place. They've also made some more nuts and bolts changes, like having in-service training efforts to allow firefighters to train at their station, and that reduces out-of-service time and demand on other firefighters to backfill. And then things like reopening Fire Station 23, frankly, which decreased response times in Clinton Triangle and Southeast Portland.
Do high-priority incidents include urgent medical incidents, or are they limited to fire incidents?
Good question. So they are they include medical incidents. In fact, that's the bulk of high priority incidents that the fire bureau is responding to, and those are in the orange category. The orange bar, rather. And then fire is a pretty small portion of incidents that PFR responds to. That's the red, and then other incident types that don't fall in either of those categories. Good question. So, BOIC. 911 calls are also going up at BOIC if you look at a trend over several years. And one takeaway here is that really that growth is actually being driven by non-emergency calls. So I know that there's a lot going on with this graph, but emergency calls are in the red bar, and non-emergency calls are in the gray. And you see the sum is the sort of the yellow line up top. So that's a pretty interesting trend, and I think it speaks to next steps in the sense of we know that there's a push around having better non-emergency communication with our community through 311. You know, that won't necessarily be a solution right away, but is that a longer-term solution to what we're seeing in growth around non-emergency calls to BOIC? BOIC is also, I think I want to note here, it's not on the graph, but BOIC has also maintained their call response time. So that's their key measure is the percentage of calls that are answered within 20 seconds. And the report there is we're still answering about 64% of calls within that 20-second period, and that's about the same as the reported time that we had from 16-17, despite the increase in call volume. So, and again, BOIC is making some changes to their business processes. They've added staff, so some promising things at work there, and we're hoping to see even better outcomes in the future. I'll keep moving here. I know we have a lot to cover. All right, so wanted to touch on the important topic of police accountability. And here we really see the police bureau and the city at large. We have multiple efforts underway, and we're making a significant amount of investment on this front. So the police open data portal, I think this is one that where we actually don't talk about it enough. There's a huge amount of policing data and analysis available on the Bureau's open data portal. It even includes data on PPB's use of force. So it's a very open data portal, a lot of interesting information there. And that's a really important step in terms of transparency and accountability with the community. making that information available. There's new audit services staff in the Bureau, and that's looking more broadly at implementing professional standards and then providing additional communication back to operational staff. Of course, we have the body camera program. It provides for $1.7 million in ongoing and 4 FTE as it was approved in 16-17. And once implemented, you know, we're really looking to have that program be evaluated for impacts on measures of police accountability.
But to be clear, the council hasn't said to go ahead with it yet.
That is interesting. I think that's one thing where that's fair, and it sounds like the Bureau needs to come forward with their plan. It has been, from the budget perspective, so from our side of the table, it's been approved for several years.
Right, so we've got the money there, should the council choose to do it, and I'm sure once Commissioner Hardesty gets here, we'll have that conversation.
Fair enough. Good point there. Well, thank you. So, and just one last thing on police accountability. It's the compliance officer and community liaison, and then the new Portland community on community engagement policing, so the COPL PSAP. We have some significant resources dedicated towards those activities this year, really intended to increase our community members' access to the Bureau, create those spaces in which members are able to air grievances, voice policy concerns, and make recommendations. So we'll be looking for impacts of those changes as well. All right. Everyone's favorite topic, use of overtime at public safety agencies. So I want to keep this high level. So we do see some different trends in terms of our use of overtime, whether we're depending on which bureau we're looking at. Use of overtime at BOIC promisingly has decreased 25% from the prior year. That's probably mostly from the Bureau's staffing up. So they've been able to add staff, whereas in previous years, we didn't see as much of that. They've also particularly reduced their use of force over time, which is great for employee involvement. Moving on, looking at the Fire Bureau. This one is a little bit confusing, admittedly. So an interesting finding here is that even though the non-reimbursable overtime hours, so those are overtime hours that essentially the Bureau is paying for, doesn't include things like wildfire assignments and where we're getting fully reimbursed by outside agencies, that the number of hours actually went down. However, the spending went up slightly, just a touch from last year. And there's a couple reasons for that. One major driver is that as the cost per hour of a firefighter increases, with our labor costs, as our labor costs rise, time and a half increases even more. There's also some wonky changes where basically there's a retroactive pay amount that hit in last year. So that may account for actually the net of the difference. But I think the key message there is as our labor costs rise for these types of employees in the city, the cost of overtime becomes even more of a driver on those budgets.
Why if the overtime has increased slightly, why is the bar for 2017-18 actually
down? Sure.
Down.
No, that's a fair question, and that's mostly a graph design issue. But I would say we're really trying to communicate two pieces of important information there, and the bar is showing you overtime hours paid. So that actually did go down by 5%. So the bar, if you look to the left, is around about 200,000 hours, and then. But we're also trying to communicate is that the cost actually went up.
And so that's the cost just per hour is higher, but the number of hours is lower?
Exactly.
Okay,
so want to have just one more finding on around overtime, and then we'll move to our summary. And that's really that... is that the total cost of police bureau, when we look at the police bureau, our overtime spending has gone up. And so last year it was $11.6 million. You see that from the graph. That's a 9.4% increase over the prior year. And then, again, this graph is sort of set up similarly where the bars show the overtime hours paid. In this case, both our number of hours have gone up and our overtime hours cost. So it's really driven by both the number of hours and the cost per hour of overtime, especially with changes in officer compensation. So that is an important finding, and I know that there's been a lot of work collaboratively across the bureaus to take a look at that, and I'll let Tom and Jessica speak to that a little bit in our next step slides.
So briefly to summarize what we just went through. So our key findings are really that emergency calls for service are increasing. All of our public safety, our key public safety bureaus, police, BOIC, and fire, have all maintained their emergency response times in the face of rising demand, and that's a real achievement. So again, the purpose of this presentation is not just to highlight the things that need improvement, but also to highlight where wins are happening and bureaus are using data or other process improvements to maintain service levels despite challenges. Additionally, CBO recommends that ongoing police bureau pilots should be evaluated for impacts on response times and officer availability, including the new community service officers or the PS3s and the BOIC sergeant pilot, which Katie alluded to. That's over at BOIC currently. So again, there's a lot of exciting things happening in these bureaus, and there's also a lot of resources that have been dedicated to increased staffing. So we just want to note that we got to keep an eye on the impact of those investments. One of the other findings is clearly that reported person and property crimes have worsened in recent years. Again, so tracking the impact of the additional officers on crime rates, and to Commissioner Udaly's point, I want to add that, you know, perhaps disaggregating that information a little bit better so we understand what the drivers and then therefore understanding that maybe an officer is not the appropriate, increasing officers might not be the appropriate response to reduce crime rates in all situations. And then also on that note to look at the other ways that we address crime throughout the city, which includes the Office of Community and Civic Life and the Crime Prevention Program. And so looking closely at that program and figuring out a way to measure that program's performance and join that with our overall public safety goals and our crime prevention goals. Finally, with the overtime cost increase, CEO Reinhart has been working on this issue, and I'm going to turn it over to him.
So, Council, if we hearken back to a few weeks ago when Chief Financial Officer Cooperman was addressing you on long-term financial strategies and planning, I think you'll remember that the personnel costs part of the graph was shown to rapidly be approaching 70% of general fund resources and forecasted to go above that. If we connect that to what our city economist just laid out in terms of looking at potentially more limited general fund resources in the near term, I want you to know that we got ahead of this on overtime costs, and I want to credit Director Summers McGee, our CHRO, and Ashley Grundy from her team, who have worked closely with AC Davis and Catherine Ryland and others from the Police Bureau on really looking at what can be done on police overtime costs as a first effort. I know Council directed this in the last budget cycle and had very direct conversations around wanting to see that reduced in any way possible and responsibly done. They have come up with a series of options that they're looking at a menu of potential actions, working with the mayor's office on what to propose, but it is safe to say that there are potentially some very significant savings there. And I want to credit everybody for doing a lot of hard work, not easy work, at a table together to figure that out. We also believe that those types of pilots should be extended. So in the other two couple slides you saw here, we do think there's opportunities to change the way we actually just assign and how we manage it internally so that overtime costs can be more effectively controlled. Any slight reduction we have in personnel costs over the near and medium term, as you know, have huge implications long term. So please look forward to more specific proposals from us. But I wanted to give credit where credit is due, because we added that to people's job duties over the last 6 months, and they really came through.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Okay, so we have 20 minutes left, so I'm going to keep it pretty high level in talking about the last two sections. And there's these are a little bit shorter in terms of the findings, but I do think they're really important. So we look at increasing city sustainability. This section, we're looking at our trends around our carbon reduction efforts and transportation mode share. The city of Portland has been at the forefront of many policies and regulations in this arena. What we find is really probably more drastic interventions may be needed to ensure that we're meeting our goals in the future. So, and this first graph really communicates that pretty well, I think. So when we look at our carbon emissions. This graph shows the reduction in per-person carbon emissions from 1990 level. So it's a little bit of a something to wrap your brain around. But what we're trying to understand is how much are we reducing our carbon emissions from a set point in the past. And for a long time, we were making a lot of progress on that. And that progress has really stagnated over the last 4 years. Josh had talked earlier in the presentation about the booming economy and how we're seeing more traffic woes. And it does correspond with an increase in transportation sector emissions that we saw for the first time since 07. So one potential reason, we don't know for sure, but one potential reason for the stagnation could be our increase in transportation sector emissions.
And when did we approve Uber and Lyft?
That's what I was just
I can't remember. That was actually a serious
certainly
question.
In that during those years. Yeah. Sure. And so there's other changes too. In terms of what we're doing about that, we're doing a lot. You know, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability has obviously a lead role in this. They are working to address the issue by implementing the Climate Action Plan. We've got strategies around increasing our use of active transportation, which we'll talk about on the next slide, but also renewable fuels. So the Poop to Power program, I hate to mention it while Commissioner Fish is out, but there's almost too many things in the city to even talk about adequately. But that program where a new program where we're converting wastewater into natural gas for our fleet and then selling the remainder to the private sector. So that's just one thing we're doing. We're electrifying our fleet to reduce emissions. So I think one interesting thing here is it would be great to know more about the impacts of those specific programs, the localized impacts, and so that we're able to continue to lead and sort of show our work, if you will. We're committed to city pacts and international commitments to reduce carbon, and we're doing our work. So I think we want to show what those impacts of those programs are.
So I'll put in a shameless plug for our diesel procurement strategy, which is coming to council soon.
Excellent.
And you know, my suspicion is that part of this dramatic increase that you see in 14-15 that's been maintained has to do with construction as well. We don't control private sector fleets.
Right.
And as you know, Oregon is something of a wild, wild west when it comes to diesel emissions. And that, to me, is an obvious area where we could get back on track with our carbon emission goals.
Fantastic.
Is addressing that at the state level.
Great point, Mayor. Thank you. And so we talked.
You missed the conversation about poop to power. We were feeling sorry for you.
Got to mention.
Hey, thank you for raising it.
And, you're
welcome. We'll use. We process 30 million gallons of wastewater a year. The byproduct, one of the most significant byproducts, is methane gas, which we currently use for a variety of purposes, including generating electricity. But the real promise here is converting it to renewable natural gas, running our trucks, selling the excess capacity on the market, and returning a profit for our ratepayers. So that's the triple dividend if it all works out.
Fantastic. Thank you.
So thank you for mentioning that.
Excellent. So one more slide in this section. We track our active transportation usage in Portland. And here's one where we know that we perform, generally speaking, we have higher active transportation modes than other cities. But we're well below our long-term target. So the Bureau of Transportation has a long-term target of 70% of Portlanders using walking, bicycling, and transit modes. And so that's an interesting thing. Again, this is one where the Bureau is doing a lot to counterbalance this. And we also have policies in places that create an environment that we need to monitor as well. So we just wanted to point this out because I think these strategies, the Portland Progress, Climate Action Plan, and the Bike Plan, are additional levers we can use and tools that we have to address, our carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm. So walking went up a bit, biking stayed the same, transit went down. Sorry, the other way around. But, yeah, transit
right,
went
right.
down. So when the city of Corvallis went fare-free, their ridership increased 37%. And I think we need to do something like that, particularly since we know that there's a million car rides a year that weren't happening before we authorized the transportation network companies, which Commissioner Hugh Daly looked up, and it was the end of 2014.
Fantastic. Thank you for grabbing that. Yep. Great point there. Yep. So in addition to that as a strategy, we have some ideas about how to move this forward.
Yeah, so really kind of the overarching story of this area is that we've done fantastic work. We've established some really great high-level visionary goals. But what we find that we're missing is sort of a performance reporting on the individual efforts that we're doing and how those are helping us get to those larger visionary goals. So our recommendation is that performance reporting, we should enhance our performance reporting on some of these many efforts that we're making and understand specifically how we're beginning to move the needle locally. Again, this is another issue area where there's a lot of policies in place, either federally or at the state level, that impact our ability to reach these overall goals. So we need to understand really locally what are we capable of doing, and are we taking the best steps to get where we're trying to go. As part of this, we also want to leverage our partners to achieve city sustainability goals through some of the opportunities we've already taken advantage of. These include Bloomberg American Cities Climate Challenge, Smart Cities Initiative, and Zero Net Carbon Cities Project. Again, this is specifically with regards to active transportation, again, expanding our publicly reported performance measures to capture all of the impacts that all of the efforts that particularly the Transportation Bureau is undertaking to reach our active transportation goals.
Thank you. Okay, last but not least, using data and technology to improve government outcomes. And this is where we want to highlight some big wins that we're seeing in the bureaus that we'd love to see spread. That's our really, and hopefully Tom will be able to speak to that. It's talking about how we've used data analytics in our Bureau of Human Resources to improve our performance. We also want to touch on some areas where we're still seeing challenges, and that's mostly around data management and reporting. We'll look at a particular use case on equity. So, first up, data management and really moving towards a more modern business intelligence system is important for the city to be able to achieve better results with our current resources. And I can't say this enough. I mean, this is something that the bureaus are thinking about and looking out over the next few years. And we know that we can't just keep applying new resources towards our same problems. We have to be able to think about doing things differently. And one key strategy with that is having better information on what we're doing and then making different decisions from that. So we do have multiple pilots in place, and they're pretty exciting. They are cross-bureau. So both of these pilots here that I described a little bit, the Portland Urban Data Lake, I know you've heard a lot about that as part of our Smart Cities Initiative. And that's one where the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability is collaborating with, you know, not only technology and transportation here in the city, but also with our regional partners, Metro and TriMet. There's a phase one pilot around this that's around transportation, really. So without going into, you know, the specifics of the technology, you know, the interesting thing is I think that pilot really paves the way for the long-term vision of how we manage our data and share our data with the public. But it doesn't actually address our internal challenges, which are significant. So I just wanted to note that. So one way that other bureaus are looking to address those internal data management challenges and move the ball forward is specifically, you know, the Tableau platform. So that's just one example. There's several bureaus that have established basically this data analytics platform within their bureau. And then there's an effort from bureaus that are interested in having a more citywide enterprise business intelligence system. So again, without getting into the nitty-gritty, that's really one where moving forward and applying resources to establish a citywide enterprise system or an enterprise system specifically for small bureaus that can't go it alone would be a really good way to ensure that we're continuing to get data on our biggest priorities. So, you know, when we look at livability issues where we have 12 to 15 programs across at least 10 city bureaus, and we want to understand our impacts, we really can't know that because we don't have a way of efficiently or effectively sharing information between bureaus and then up to council. So it's really important to be able to make progress in especially those collaborative areas.
Shannon or Jessica, yeah. Could you speak to intermittent push to have just enterprise Tableau system and what that could potentially do? And I'm asking in the context of for citywide policymakers to not have the full lens on some of these data questions. that conversation has happened. Where does the current CBO position on that, and could you educate them on whether that would be valuable or not?
Sure. Yeah. So really our intersection with this is through performance management. So we have a lens on how the bureaus are tracking information and how they're using that information to improve their own operations. So that's and we're a convener of essentially analysts across the city. There's been packages put forward previously, and there's been a lot of conversations over the last, I'd say, year and a half. CBO has worked with analysts in the bureau to present to our Technology Executive Steering Committee a business case for having an enterprise business intelligence platform. We are still supporting that, and think what CBO is trying to do is help convene bureau staff to move the ball forward there, and to make sure that interest is still known and that bubbles up through our technology steering committee. So we'd love to see a direction develop around specifically enterprise visualization and analytics. So that could translate into a Tableau server. It probably would require additional staff resources at BTS, at least a staff person to support that.
Thank you.
Great. So one more use case. So I mentioned a couple of the sort of high-level use cases like livability, where we do need that enterprise view of data management to even know what we're doing. But another really key area, and this is one we don't talk a lot about, how technology impacts our equity outcomes, is around equity. So we know that equity is a core value, and we're seeing that change in our organizational culture. And we're seeing that even through our performance measures. So almost 100% of city employees are now trained in Equity 101. That wasn't the case several years ago. That was just a nascent goal. And we have, I believe, almost all of our bureaus, might be 100%, have their racial equity plans in place. So we're seeing an organizational shift. What we're not seeing necessarily is knowledge of what our, and this kind of harkens back to the where we started with housing, we want to know how that impacts our outcomes. So we want to know, does that mean we're translating more documents into the essential languages across our bureaus? We want to know if that means that we're removing more barriers through our investments in infrastructure, both through bureau investments and then at the citywide level. And that's where we actually don't know that. And I think that's not a new trend. That's something where we just don't necessarily have the reporting coming in through our Office of Equity. And I think that's for a lot of reasons. I mean, I think bureaus are, they are busy and they are challenged by housing that data and then reporting it. And I do think we can move the needle if we have something like a Tableau server and enterprise business intelligence to help support that. Because oftentimes it's bureaus just don't necessarily have the in-house capability to do this, and they need more support.
So duly noted on these issues. I do want to point out, in terms of the ADA transition barriers removed, some bureaus have done. So this may not reflect a ongoing effort. When I was in charge of development services, we removed all the barriers. Oh. So there may be some that come up that then need to be addressed, but it wouldn't be surprising to me if their response was, we took out zero because we already did it.
Right.
The majority of the marine now still are in parks that doesn't have funding for it. So
it could be something there too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I just don't want it to look like everybody's ignoring that, because it doesn't reflect. You know, you could have a different performance measure, bureaus that have completely removed all their barriers.
Absolutely. And I think, I think what JM or Jamie might have said is we need to know. Part of the reason we wanted to include that is just we do want to know the reporting from the bureaus. So even if the number is zero, then we need to know that.
Yeah, and we need a measure that reflects that rather than how many have you done this year, which may not. But
excellent.
Yes,
Julie
noted that. I really appreciate this information. I'll take care of it.
Thank you. Great. I think we have a few minutes left. So do you want to touch on some of the successes we've seen with your human resources?
We're running short of time, so I'll leave my speech aside. I do want to say on this human resources recruitment timelines improvement, you see the data in front of you. When I started my role as CAO, two of the things that bureau leadership and staff told me were the following. Tom, if you can do anything about recruitment timelines, if you can do anything about procurement timelines, know, God love you, basically, is what they said to me. So I want to report that what we've learned here is utilization of the data and daylighting the role of the Bureau, Internal Service Bureau, and the Partner Bureau were pivotal here. So we have now gotten through that, and thank you all as well for supporting both of those reforms and the Construction Services Division and Procurement, because we're learning how to do this with data and with clear understanding on each side what has to be done in each bureau to make sure that these are timely. So that's all I wanted to say on that, and we will continue to work with the data and work with CBO to improve.
I do just want to note on that that there's perhaps a skew in the data in that sometimes recruitments are not opening in a timely manner because human resources is swamped with the current ones. So, yes, we may have improved the recruitment completion, but have we improved the vacancy to hiring? That would be another measure.
So in our final couple of minutes, I'm just going to close. So we've talked a lot about the importance of data and governance. We know data is not always flashy. Getting the right data to empower good decision-making can be extremely challenging, but the reward is well worth it, which we've tried to show with the highlights and some of the wins in this section. In terms of next steps, so one of the key next steps, Shannon, can you explain?
Yeah.
One of the key next steps is just to continue reviewing performance information on an ongoing basis. This plays in really well with some of our changes to the budget process. There's a few tools at your disposal to use performance information to help inform your decision-making going forward through the budget process. That's the move to program offers. Each program offer is expected to have connected performance, relevant performance information. It will look a little wonky this year for a number of programs across the city because this is the first time we're really taking that viewpoint. But for many bureaus and programs, we'll be able to see that data, and that will be really informative. And also the tool of the direction to develop process. So through directions to develop, you can ask one or more bureaus to what it would take to provide a proposal of what it would take to achieve a certain outcome and really charge your subject matter experts in the bureaus to provide you with an idea of what it would take to get to the outcomes that you'd like to see. In terms of outstanding items that I heard today to work on, our office will work with the county, joint office, and PHB on what data is needed to assess the impact of our homeless services. We'll look at what other homeless data indicators are available to help give us a more robust picture of the houseless population. We'll work with the CAO and Portland Public, and Police Bureau on comparative crime data, and we will look at differentiating the crime data between types of crime. And CEO Reinhart, did you have any other?
Nothing to add.
So I want to ask my colleagues and I want to ask our budget advisors if they have any further comments, thoughts, questions. Good. This was a great presentation. It raised a bunch of very interesting and provocative and timely issues. Thanks for preparing it for us.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
Very good. Yes, good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very good.
Nice to see you again.
You probably have online.
Yeah.
Like a standard different dates, nobody.
Okay. Come up with me. I can't meet with you now because I'm booked solid between now and tonight. But yeah, let's get it. Let's get it on the schedule. Got it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Out there.